the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
I have a fascinating book here in front of me. It's called The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. And we're joined by its author, Suzanne O'Sullivan. Suzanne, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I should say Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, because I think that's really important, isn't it, that you are writing this book from a position of expertise.
Yeah, I'm writing this book because I look after a lot of really young patients who have accruing long lists of medical diagnoses. That's become a kind of growing problem in the last 15, 20 years in my practice. And it really worries me because I don't see them getting better. I just see them sometimes gathering labels that don't seem to be leading anywhere.
Because your particular type of medicine is?
So I'm a neurologist. I look after people with brain diseases. And I see kind of young people with epilepsy, but they will also, and blackouts and similar problems, but they often come to me also with a diagnosis of autism, ADHD, anxiety, and a variety of other related disorders, and I have no objection to people getting a diagnosis that leads them to recovery. I don't see these labels leading to recovery.
When you say they come to you with the diagnosis, somebody else has diagnosed them in advance of you, is it?
Yes. I think that people with... once a person is medicalized within the system with a medical problem, it's very easy for them to attract diagnosis for various complaints. If you go to a doctor with a set of symptoms, these days it's become easier to attract a label rather than just ordinary reassurance.
Why is that?
Well, I think there's a kind of collusion between the public and doctors, I would say, to provide answers. You know, people come to us desperate for answers. And it's a very satisfying consultation for us if we can give an answer.
Is that almost demanded by some patients, that they almost want confirmation of what they think themselves or what they might have found on Dr. Google or they've been told by friends? And that if a doctor tells them, actually, no, you're not ADHD or autistic or whatever, that they get disappointed or angry by that?
Yeah, I think sometimes that a diagnosis is seen as... something that is worth having because it's validating, and that people don't always fully understand that a diagnosis can give relief in some ways, but it can reinforce symptoms in other ways. So it can focus you on the things that you can't do, and it can lower your expectations of overcoming difficulties. So at the moment, I think, you know, diagnoses like autism and ADHD are seen as validating and they're seen as giving explanations. And I certainly don't want to, I should say, take away a diagnosis from someone who is finding it genuinely helpful. I want to caution people that a diagnosis is not inert. It has the power to make you feel better in some ways, but it can disable you through the labeling effect in other ways. People take on the identity of labels that are given to them.
In what way?
Well, if you are told that you have a particular illness or disease, it kind of doesn't really matter what it is. It could be diabetes, it could be asthma, it could be autism or ADHD. Then you become familiar with the difficulties or symptoms that go along with that medical disorder. You search your body for them. If you start searching your life or your body for abnormalities, that you will find things, because our bodies are awash with imperfections. So it's very easy to kind of conform to a label. There was an interesting study on people with heart disease, a congenital heart disease called cardiomyopathy. And they found that people who identified with the illness very strongly, where it became part of their identity, they were sort of engulfed by it, that they had much more hospital presentations and much more symptoms than people who had worse heart disease who did not identify as with the cardiomyopathy. Because being aware of symptoms makes you pay a lot of attention to them. When you pay attention to things, they become more obvious.
You may have noticed I smiled when you mentioned diabetes and asthma, because I'm diabetic type 2 and I'm asthmatic.
Okay.
So, and I've mentioned this on air on a number of occasions in recent years since I was diagnosed with both. But I would argue that it's made me take more care of myself and that it has been a good thing, that if I hadn't been diagnosed, I would have continued with the ill health path that I was on, whereas now I feel so much better because I'm getting the proper treatment.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly is the theory by which, so say, for example, in diabetes, we've been gradually adjusting. Not, when I say we, I mean scientific community, certainly not me, has been gradually adjusting the level at which pre-diabetes is diagnosed. for exactly the reason that you describe, which is that basically we will encourage people to have lifestyle changes that will prevent diabetes, and which is obviously a very serious illness or disease. The difficulty with it is that to save a small number of people from developing diabetes and the complications of diabetes, you have to overdiagnose a much larger number of people. So when one set of criteria was changed for diagnosing prediabetes, it meant that a third of Chinese adults would have prediabetes according to new criteria. No, sorry, half of Chinese adults and a third of UK adults. So these are huge numbers of people. Now, how many of these people would actually have developed diabetes in the next 10 years? Well, you know, the smallest percentage of them. Now, you can say what people will argue is that, you know, but, you know, lifestyle changes, that's not harmful. So these people have been encouraged to do the right things anyway. But when you turn a healthy person into a patient, that can affect them psychologically in ways that are unpredictable. So I think we've always tolerated the fact that to save a small number, we medicalize a large number. But I don't think we've ever really examined what happens to that large number of people. The other difficulty often with screening is that it works for white middle-class educated people. It's not necessarily targeting the people who need it most, which are often people in deprived communities, for example. Often it works well with people who are already intelligent and motivated.
But sometimes the diagnosis can be correct. And I just use my own circumstances as well. I was exhibiting symptoms which were interfering with my day-to-day life. If I hadn't had the diagnosis and had the treatments required, I think my life would be significantly worse now than it is.
Well, we are talking then about something completely different, because you're talking about symptomatic disease. So symptomatic disease is always needs to be diagnosed and treated. I'm talking about early diagnosis of asymptomatic illness or disease. So these are people who are at high risk of potentially developing problems in the future, don't have any symptoms or medical problems at the time. Only a small percentage of them will actually convert to disease, and we accept the risk of medicalizing the lives of the ones who won't. But symptomatic illness, well, that's plays by a different set of rules.
I'm glad to get that clarification. And let's come back again to things like autism and ADHD, because there are extraordinary increases in the numbers of people with diagnoses. And I was talking to a school principal recently who suggested to me that in 1 year in his school, one in five of the boys has some sort of issue that has been diagnosed, in which they're making adjustments to their education because of that. Is that down to changes in lifestyle or some reason that has brought that about? Or could it be that we just simply have better diagnosis and understanding of things that we didn't understand in previous generations?
Well, I think it's the process started by us trying to correct a problem that was definitely there. So, you know, I went to school in the 70s, 80s. Nobody was recognised as having learning needs then. Clearly, there must have been children who could have benefited from support.
I bet you can remember people that you were at school with who, in retrospect, weren't been treated at the time
I
as having...
You're overestimating how good my memory is there. So I don't remember specific people, but on the law of averages, I know that there must have been people who needed help who didn't get it. So we needed to correct that. So what we have done is we have gradually, well, we're looking more closely for people who have difficulties, but that's not the thing that worries me. The thing that worries me is we're also completely changing the definition of what some of these medical problems are. So if we say in the 1940s, autism was called extreme autistic aloneness, the children who were affected by it just could not function in the world at all. And then someone changed it slightly and said, well, maybe it's on a spectrum to include milder people. And that has just gone on and changed till we get to a point now where someone might not exhibit any of the typical autistic behaviours, but might still be called autistic if they say that they feel them on the inside, but they're socially compensating or masking them. So we've really made what is required to be diagnosed as autistic milder and milder over time. And the big question is it working? Because that would still be the right thing to do if it was working, if these one-fifth of people in school got the extra help and flourished in life. The difficulty I have and the reason it's overdiagnosis is because I see no evidence it's working. So in the UK, 27% of children get special accommodations in school. If that was working, then we should see better adjusted young adults. but we're actually seeing much higher mental health problems in young adults and higher university dropout rates. So where is the payoff from all these diagnoses in school? We now have a new population with autism in school and another new population with mental health problems in adulthood.
Okay, this is a slight diversion maybe from what's in the book, but given that you're a neurologist, how much of that lack of attention do you put down to things like attention to mobile phones and social media? I mean, that's a new phenomenon of the last couple of decades.
Yeah, I think a lot of people attribute difficulties both in mental health and attention to social media and mobile phones. But actually, the evidence to support that is really lacking. It's one of those received wisdom things. You know, we spend a lot of time saying social media is affecting the mental health of young people. But actually, if you look at longitudinal studies where they follow young people using social media and correlate with that with their mental health, they find almost no relationship between these two things. You can sometimes find, if you look at a point in time, people with mental health problems are more likely to use social media. So that could be working either way, that the, you know, if you'd look at a point in time, children with lower mental health spend more time on social media. That can be explained by the fact that they don't go out so much, that they're more socially isolated. But if you follow kids over time, the evidence for social media being the cause is really lacking.
But isn't there also the case that people who follow things on social media and who end up going down rabbit holes of what I call Dr. Google start self-diagnosing as having mental health issues that they then want reinforcement of? Yeah.
No, I definitely don't want to say that social media has never harmed anyone or that social media isn't harmful if people happen upon the wrong contact or on the wrong content, for example. The way I kind of think about it is that it's like a busy road. You know, people have been harmed on busy roads, but you teach your children how to negotiate a busy road and the vast majority of them don't come to harm. Vulnerable people are vulnerable, and vulnerable people may find themselves harmed by social media. But as a majority of the population, there's little evidence that a young, well-supported young person is harmed by social media.
There's one other thing I want to bring up with you, which you do cover in the book, and this again is the subject of some controversy in recent years, long COVID. Mm-hmm. What's your view on the prevalence of what's come to be known as long COVID, given that it's not necessarily easily defined, is it, what it actually is?
Yeah, well, that's been the difficulty with the conversation. Long COVID arose as a hashtag on social media on the 20th of May 2020, and then it kind of took off in media and entered politicians' mouths and doctors' mouths without anyone saying, you know, what is it exactly? It didn't have any set of definable symptoms. There was no test to prove it. It was really a label that when people were suffering in the pandemic, a label that was used to account for that suffering. You know, there's no doubt that people in intensive care will have long persistent symptoms, and that may be one form of long COVID. There's no doubt that all viruses can cause a post-viral fatigue syndrome in some people. That will account for some of the people with long COVID. But there's no doubt in my mind at all that a large percentage of people with long COVID have a psychosomatic disorder. It's very important that people understand psychosomatic disorders are real, disabling. That should not be seen as a dismissal, but rather as a mechanism for what happens. Let's face it, you know, the pandemic was a perfect storm for developing a psychosomatic disorder. You turn on the news and you hear that 1,000 people died today, and then you are literally ordered to examine your body for signs that you might be the next person who's going to get sick and potentially die. The minute you start examining your body for symptoms, you will find things, and that's how psychosomatic problems get out of control.
It's a fascinating book. The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health, and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. Dr. Susanna Sullivan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.